So today's May 30th, and it's Wednesday morning. We're learning in the Shivim Panim curriculum Amalek, which is the last of the 10 units. And if we have a class next week, we'll continue the same unit. There's enough material here, very, very intriguing material for at least two sessions. So the workbook has us on page 247, and even though it says there that we're looking at two passages, one from Shemot and one from Dvarim, we're actually beginning with a passage from Genesis, from Bereshit. And I wrote that on the sheet that I prepared, which is Bereshit chapter 36, to give a little background to this matter of Amalek. So here we go. Bereshit 36. Yeah, you both have the same edition there. It's pages 56 and 57. Mm-hmm. So this is a genealogical list of the line of Esav, something you might not expect to be so interesting. But we're going to look there in verses 10 to 12 and then 15 and 16. So 10 to 12, these are the names of Esav's sons. Let's just remember who Esav is, right? Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Yitzhak had two sons, not just Yaakov, but Esav. And that's where we have the stealing of the blessing from his father. Yaakov impersonated his brother and took the blessing. And Esav was quite upset about that, justifiably so, as you remember. He vowed to kill his brother. So it says, these are the names of Esav's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Esav's wife, Ada; Reuel, the son of Esav's wife, Bosmat. So each of those two wives had one son. The sons of Eliphaz were, which means now we're looking at the grandsons of Esav, the sons of his son. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. That really doesn't have to concern us too much. Timnah was a concubine of Esav's son Eliphaz. She bore Amalek to Eliphaz. So the nation that is later called Amalek is a grandson of Esav, and not a completely legitimate grandson. He's rather the son of one of the concubines of Esav's son. And when we think of a concubine, and certainly the children of a concubine, it's someone who's not completely within the line of the family. He's a little bit of an outcast, perhaps. He's seen as an outsider. So if Esav is an outsider in the family of Yaakov, because he's the rejected child, so here we have a reject of a reject, the son of a concubine who's part of a line who himself has been rejected. And then we're going to look at verses 15 and 16. These are the clans of the children of Esav. The descendants of Esav's firstborn, Eliphaz, again, grandsons now of of Esav, the clans Teman, Omar, Zepho, Kenaz, Korach, Gatam, and Amalek. So that's basically more or less a repetition of the names of the grandsons, but it's saying that each grandson is the founder of a clan. These are the clans of Eliphaz in the land of Edom. That's all. So we're already told that there's going to be a clan and later a nation called Amalek, which comes from the grandson of Esav. That's all. That's the background. And with that, we can go to the material that we're looking at today. Okay. So we can look in a textbook or look in the Chumash itself. It's Shemot 17. Shemot 17. The reason that I think it's a little bit better to look at it in the Chumash rather than the textbook is because when you look at it in the Chumash, you can see the context, what came before and what comes afterwards. Yeah. So if we look in the Chumash in chapter 17, it's on page 111. It comes right after the manna, so we learned about last week. And of course, if you turn a page backwards, the manna came right after the song at the sea that the Israelites sang when they left the mud of the sea and came out into dry land, which of course means we're right after the Exodus. We're just a few short chapters after the Exodus. Remember, the Exodus was chapters 12 and 13. Splitting of the sea was 14 and 15, and 16 was the man. And here we are in chapter 17. So it's chapter 17, verses 8 to 16. Ready? Mm-hmm. Chapter 17, verse 8, and henceforth. Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. And you know what? I just thought of it. Let's see a few verses before that.
Okay.
Because it's one of the commentaries that's going to look at that. So the verses before that are the Israelites in the desert, and they're complaining that there's no water. They don't have anything to drink. And they're very angry with God and with Moshe. And let's just read the verse 7. The last verse of that matter, verse 7, 17:7. The place was named Massah and Merivah, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tried the Lord, saying, is the Lord present among us or not? And then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. Moses said to Yeshua, pick some men for us and go out and do battle with Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. That's the staff that he had done all the plagues with. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moshe, Aaron, and Hor went up to the top of the hill. Then whenever Moshe held up his hand, Israel prevailed. But whenever he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew heavy, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hor, one on each side, supported his hands. Thus his hands remained steady until the sun set. And Yeshua overwhelmed the people of Amalek with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moshe, inscribe this in a document as a reminder and read it aloud to Joshua, to Yeshua. I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moshe built an altar and named it Adonai Nisi, which means God is my banner or God is my miracle. He said, it means hand upon the throne of the Lord will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages.
We don't know why he attacked and why this attack, of all the attacks throughout this book, this one is one that we hate for all ages, Amalek. We hate for all ages.
It doesn't say what you just said, but you've got it right. In other words, you have absorbed the atmosphere and the thrust of rabbinic Judaism that we are trained that Amalek is for some reason something to be hated and abhorred, even though the word hate doesn't appear here, but you're right.
Yeah.
That's the way Jewish tradition, to a large degree, has understood it. So we have to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
So, to go back and ask some questions in the verses that we just read, obviously, like Carol Ann said, one of the first questions is, why did Amalek come? And it might be interesting, some of the commentators will pick up on this, it doesn't just say that Amalek made a war with Israel, it says they came and fought. So what is this coming? Like, where did they come from? Why is that extra verb there? We'll see some commentators that talk about that. I put on the sheet some additional questions. Question number one, what do you think might be the purpose or the message of the matter of the hands of Moshe? I'm just going to close the door.
I think that maybe he's...
Yeah.
Beseeching God to help, to keep, you know, the Israelites should win.
Yeah, it's obviously there's something to do with God. And Moses has something in his hand. And he has the staff, which was the staff of the Otot, of the signs he had done in Egypt, for example, the turning of the water into blood that he did when he came in front of Paro to show that he has credentials that he represents God. And later the 10 plagues were all with the staff of God. So Moses arranges this war so that it's not just the Israelites fighting the Amalekites, but there's another element here. There's Moses up in the mountain with the staff. So I think it's pretty clear it indicates some type of divine element in the war, that it's not just a battle on human terms, that somehow God is involved. And indeed, every time Moses puts his hands down, so the staff is not present, if you will, they start failing in the war, and the opposite when he puts his hands up. So it comes to tell us that this war is not simply on the plane of military power. It has something to, it's a miracle. It's a miracle, a miraculous war, just like the splitting of the Red Sea and the 10 plagues.
Sort of a curious picture to think about, him sitting on a rock with each of somebody supporting each of his arms.
Yeah.
There is a
sort of, right, and it doesn't say what's the importance of his arms being up or not, but all I can think of is the staff.
Yeah.
Right? The importance of that staff. Okay. So, another question is, from the context of the story, can we venture a guess as to how or in what fashion God will blot out the memory of Amalek or be at war with him? Right, because this is the end, that God says in verse 14, I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And in the last verse it says, the Lord will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages. So, a question I might ask is, how do we think God is going to do that? Without defining yet, what is it that God's going to do? But how is God going to do it? From the context of the story.
Yes, you know, with Joshua and when Moses and Joshua disappear from the scene, maybe this battle will be forgotten, otherwise, except mm-hmm. that he's going to somehow make this stay in the memory of the people.
In the memory of the people. And how is God going to be at war with Amalek?
I don't know.
Okay, if you don't know, then I'm not going to say anything, because we're going to look at other verses that might give a hint.
Okay. I've heard things that somehow he attacked the people from behind or something like
mm-hmm.
that, killing off people, sort of like it was like it wasn't a fair fight, so to speak.
Okay, that's what the verses say in Deuteronomy that we're about to see. Right?
Talking about this battle, it wasn't a fair
fight.
Yeah,
that Amalek's people, they picked off the slow, the weak, people from behind, the Israelites that were behind in the rear. They would just pick off the weak people.
Cause,
so they didn't fight fair.
They didn't fight fair. Right, and that's already the beginning of an answer of what is so bad about Amalek. They don't fight according to the Geneva Convention. Right, and that comes from Deuteronomy. We're about to see, because remember, Deuteronomy is a recapitulation of the earlier books of the Torah. Moses is retelling some of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
But just before we go there, I just want to say one more thing about these verses, which is the question I asked on my sheet in 3B3. Do you see any contradiction between verses 14 and 16?
What? They seem the same. I mean, he wants to be sure that it's passed along. Inscribe it in a document, pass it on to Joshua,
mm-hmm.
Apparently we'll pass it on throughout the ages to other people.
But there is something that's contradictory.
Hand on the cross.
On 14 he says he's going to make it a reminder, and then he says he's going to blot it out.
Mm-hmm. And how does that contradict verse 16?
Blot out the memory, how can you be at war with it at the same
right.
time?
Right. It's either one or the other.
Yeah.
Either there's going to be a continuing war forever or not, or else the war will have an end point at some time. From verse 14, it looks like I'm going to blot out the memory, period. Once God blots out the memory, there's no more war.
Mm-hmm.
Verse 16 seems to say the war will be forever. In other words, there will never be a blotting out. It'll be a constant struggle. constant battle. That's pretty contradictory.
Yeah.
And that's going to play a central role in the biblical exegesis of the rabbis throughout the generations. Okay, there's a lot of questions. Let's get more questions by looking at the version of all this that we find in Deuteronomy. So we're going to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy chapter 25. It's pretty near the end of the book of Deuteronomy.
3:13.
25:17. Remember what Amalek did to you on your journey. And this is Moses 40 years later looking back. After you left Egypt, how, undeterred by fear of God, he surprised you on the march when you were famished and weary and cut down all the stragglers in your rear. Therefore, when the Lord your God grants you safety from all your enemies around you, in the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a hereditary portion, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget.
This is the same contradiction here. Blot it out, don't forget. Or maybe just don't forget to blot it out.
But that's a very good point,
yeah.
Right? If you do blot it out, then what is there not to forget? So you gave a good answer. Perhaps it means don't forget to blot it out. But once you blot it out, now you can forget because you're finished. But you're right. It's kind of the same type of tension that we have over there in Exodus between the continuing battle on the one hand, and on the other hand, the battle has a certain end point.
Of course, I have a note here. It was probably came from you some years ago.
Really?
It says that blot out, it could mean that just to make sure there's no more Amaleks.
I don't know if that's for me because I don't remember ever actually teaching this.
Okay.
But you never know. I have an excellent ability to forget.
You taught a whole year of Deuteronomy.
That's true. That's true. So, if we ask the question in Exodus that we'd have an answer for, how do you think God is going to blot out the memory? Well, Deuteronomy gives an answer to that. How is God going to do it? The answer is in Deuteronomy. My question is so simple that
they're
you think it's complicated.
Safe. They're going to be safe so they don't have to think about any enemies or remember.
Who's going to be safe?
The people.
The Israelites,
right.
Where do you see that?
Well, therefore, when the Lord your God grants you safety from all your enemies around you, in the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a hereditary portion,
then you should blot out the memory of Amalek.
Blot out the memory.
In other words, only go and make war with Amalek when all your local enemies are subdued. That's what it means. When you go and conquer the land of Canaan, don't take upon yourself Amalek while you still have local enemies that you have to deal with. But once you deal with those local enemies, then go get Amalek. But back to my question. If Exodus said that God is going to blot out the memory of Amalek, then in Deuteronomy, I claim it says how he's going to do that. How is he going to do that? Through the agency of... You don't hear what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying, but I don't see the answer there.
Okay. Then I'll present in the following fashion. The verb blot out. Mm-hmm. Who is the subject of the verb in the book of Exodus, and who is the subject in the book of Deuteronomy? That's who is the performer of the action of blotting out in Exodus, mm-hmm. and who in Deuteronomy?
Well, in Exodus is God.
Right. And in Deuteronomy?
It's the Israelites.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, when it says in Exodus that God is going to do this blotting out, Deuteronomy tells us how God is going to do it, by telling us to do it. In other words, through the agency of the Jewish people. It when it says God's going to do it, what it means is God is going to have us do it.
Okay.
So you see here a transference of responsibility, mm-hmm. in a certain sense. The Jewish people become an agent of God in performing this important, we don't know why it's important, mm-hmm. but this important mitzvah. Okay. Let's see. So we just answered on my sheet question C3, which asked what might be the relationship between the blotting out of the memory of Amalek mentioned in Shemot and the blotting out of the memory of Amalek mentioned here in Deuteronomy. And I'm claiming that Deuteronomy is the means, the way it will be done. Exodus says God's going to do it, and Deuteronomy says how that's going to happen through the Jewish people taking upon themselves this divine responsibility. So, if we dealt with question 3, let's do now question 2. How might we describe in modern terms the sin of Amalek?
So,
what we just said, he didn't fight fair.
Didn't fight fair. Can you flesh that out a little bit to say more about that? What didn't they do fairly?
He preyed on the weak and the weary. And
preyed on the weak and the weary.
Were just right. Left behind, struggling to try to keep up.
So how do we call that today when you don't make a frontal attack, but you just prey on individuals of the enemy? Individuals who aren't wearing a uniform.
Civilians.
Right. So how do we call...
collateral damage.
No, but here it's not collateral damage. Here it's done on purpose.
Yes, no.
Right.
Sounds like terrorism.
It's terrorism.
Oh.
We call this terrorism. Uh-huh. Right? So you can say that Amalek was the first terrorist organization in the world. That's really what it's describing. Right, that's what it's describing.
Yes.
They're preying on individuals who can be cut down by improvised explosive devices, by suicide bombers. You get the people in the rear, and that demoralizes the nation that you're fighting against. So before we go to the commentators, there's another thing I want to point out, which is that it says in verse 18 that Amalek was undeterred by fear of God. Mm-hmm. And we have to ask ourselves, well, what does that mean? Undeterred by fear of God. What is fear of God?
Undeterred.
Thank you. Right, you have no idea what it means if you pronounce it like me. Then it means nothing. Undeterred. I got it right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Undeterred by fear of God. Fear of God is... Yirei Elohim, or Yirat Elohim.
He wasn't stopped or concerned at all with nothing. He didn't have fear of God.
Didn't have fear of God. And when we talk about fear of God, I just want to point out two aspects of that. One is found at the end of Shirat Hayam. Shirat Hayam is the song at the sea when the Israelites sang about God's victory over the soldiers of Paro. There's a line there at the very end of the Shira, the song, that I want to point out. And that line, it's chapter 15 of Exodus. So in 15 of Exodus, it says in verse 14. Let me make a note of that myself. We're looking at Exodus 15:14. It says, "The peoples hear, they tremble. Agony grips the dwellers of Philistia. Now are the clans of Edom dismayed, the tribes of Moab trembling grips them. All the dwellers in Canaan are aghast, terror and dread descends upon them." In other words, the nations hear about the greatness of God at the Red Sea, at the plagues in Egypt. They say, oh, wow, that's unbelievable power. We're quaking in our boots. Mm-hmm. And that's a natural reaction. You see all this power, and you understand that there's a force, there's a godly force behind it, and you better be careful. Whereas Amalek is not Yirei Elohim. They have no fear of God. They don't take into account the miracles that they heard about at Egypt and at the Red Sea. They're oblivious to it. Or perhaps they think that they can overcome God. Or is there... They're fighting against God. They're fighting against the ideals of the Jewish people. That's one way of reading that they're not Yirei Elohim. They're fighting against God. They've heard of the things that happened But they think, like Paro thought when he first came in contact with it, he can overcome. Mm-hmm. Now, if we talked just 2 minutes ago about terrorism, and Amalek being the primordial terrorist, if you will, well, now when we talk about Amalek not being Yirei Elohim, not being fear of God, what we're really talking about is an ideological conflict. Right? They're coming with their own ideology, and they are doing battle with God. That's what we call today a clash of civilizations. Or you can even call it Al-Qaeda.
Hmm.
Right? That they have a purpose. They have a philosophy. They have a reason. However, there's another way to look at it, which is that there are lots of places in the Hebrew Bible in which fear of God is simply another way of saying natural morality, a sense of morality. Like, for example, if you remember the story in Genesis, when Avimelech, I don't remember if it was Avimelech, the king of Gerar, or if it was Paro, the king of Egypt, when they take Sarah into their harem, and Abraham tries to avoid that by saying, she's my sister. He's afraid that if he says, she's my wife, they'll just take her. And if he says, she's my sister, then they won't take her, but they take her anyway. When he's asked, why did you say, she's my sister? He says, because I was afraid that there's no fear of God around here. There's no Yirat Elohim. And there it's clear, Yirat Elohim simply means a sense of basic morality. And it could be the same thing with Amalek, that they had no basic morality. If you want to make war, then you should have a reason for it, and they don't have any reason. And if you want to make war, you should declare war. And if you want to make war, you should go head-to-head and not engage in terrorism. They don't have any basic morality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different ways of looking at it.
That would explain why he might have made war on the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would answer that question. God, they didn't have morality, basically. Thought they could be stronger.
So now, I'm moving in my sheet to D. And I want to expand the matter on three levels. So I wrote a number one, formulate the moral issues created by these verses. What I mean to say is, if we look in Deuteronomy, where it says that because of what Amalek did to the Jewish people at a certain place, at a certain time, under certain circumstances, therefore, there is a commandment, there's a mitzvah, to blot out for all time the memory of Amalek from under heaven. I'm looking again at Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 19. You shall blot out the memory of Amalek from the heaven. We don't have to go back to it if you don't have it open. So, a lot of ink has been spilled, especially in the past 50 years, over the larger moral issue of these verses. In other words, it basically goes like this. Amalek, at a certain point in history, did a certain act. And it might be that that act is terrible. It might be horrific. It might be, you might even go so far as to say that it's a prototype of the Holocaust, you might say. But even if you say all that, what is the moral justification for a mitzvah that says for all time the Jewish people should make every effort to blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven? Because if I take that literally, it means that even 200 years after the original event, or 2,000 years, or 2 million years, when the nation of Amalek has completely different people, right? Completely different character, living in a different place, perhaps a different culture, I don't know, it could be everything different. It means that you should kill, I'm assuming that's what it means, you should kill men, women, and children for the sins of their great, 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 great ancestors. So that's a pretty serious issue. Right. And certainly for moderns, that is terrible. It makes no sense. And it's not just that as modern people thrusting our values on the Bible, we have an issue, but you can actually say that it's an issue within the morals of the Bible itself. Because remember, what Abraham said to God, when God is going to kill the men, women, and children of Sodom, Avram says, "Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat," shall the judge of all the universe not do judgment? You're going to kill innocent people just because the majority are guilty? It doesn't make any sense. And God basically agrees with Avram. Yeah, you're right. I shouldn't do that. I changed my mind. You're right. And I'll save the whole city because there are some righteous people in it. You can't kill the righteous together with the innocent, says Avraham. And God seems to agree. So therefore, how could the Torah tell us to kill the children of 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 the sinners? They're not guilty. All right, the Torah says that all human beings are created in the divine image. Tzelem Elokim. So I understand that sinners might forfeit their right to life, but what about those who didn't sin? So that's a big question. That's a big issue.
You could castrate all the descendants, all his children or whatever, and then you wouldn't have any more out in Malachi.
So you'd have to castrate the originals in that generation.
Right.
Which is the same thing basically as wiping them all out. And then there's no issue. Right, so if God had wiped them all out in the battle that we read about, fine. They sinned. They did a terrible thing. They are the prototype of non-Geneva Convention following terrorists. Get them all, fine. But once that doesn't happen and they have descendants, why punish the descendants for the sins of the parents? That's hard. That's a hard question. And we'll see if any commentators have anything to say about that. But just a priori thinking about it, it looks like you'd have to say that somehow the evil of that generation of Amalek is inherent in the nation. And it's never gone. And you'd have to take some type of metaphysical approach to it like that to say that you just have to get rid of them because they'll always be rearing their ugly head. Now, of course, when I make a claim like that, or I put on the table a possibility like that, immediately someone should say, but that's racism. And it is racism, saying that a certain race is inherently evil and you have to exterminate it. That's what the Nazis said about the Jews. Right. Now, of course, you could say that, yeah, that's what the Nazis said about the Jews, but the Nazis are wrong. We're right. Amalek is an evil race and you have to exterminate it. That's also hard. Or we'll find commentators that just can't take this mitzvah at face value and have to reinterpret it because it just doesn't make any sense.
Of course, with the Holocaust, there are people who go the other way too and say that the German people are inherently racist and should be eliminated. Evil.
They're evil. I mean, that's come up before.
I mean,
we've all talked about that before. Yeah.
Yeah. And that will lead us to commentators that say, and now I'm really just giving away what certain modern time commentators say, they say that Amalek is not a genetic nation. Amalek is an idea. And that any nation, any time that acts like Amalek acted, they get the title of, they get the category of Amalek. It has nothing to do with bloodlines.
Uh-huh.
Right? That kind of solves the moral issue. And indeed, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who lived at the time of the Holocaust, said that the Nazis are Amalek, and that they embody the ideas and the methods of Amalek. It has nothing to do with bloodlines. And that when any nation embodies those ideals and those methods, then there's a mitzvah to wipe them out. And then there's a mitzvah to wipe them out, men, women, and children. When the nation as a whole is exhibiting and acting with those characteristics. That brings us back to the moral issues that are brought up at the end of World War II, when the United States carpet-bombed Dresden, for example, and killed 150,000 people in, I think, in a day, which today would be against the Geneva Convention, right? But the moral justification was that is shortening the war. The same thing with the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? You killed men, women, and children who were innocent in a certain sense, but they were part of a nation that was killing, and the way to prevent future killing and to punish the nation as a nation was they're all, in some sense, guilty. So this gets us into very, very important moral issues, these verses about Amalek, and it's all discussed in the commentators. And that's why I said that this time, at least in the unit that's been prepared for us, some very important and intriguing material has been brought.
Yeah.
So, we can start reading. Here we go. So I'm opening up the workbook, and I'm on page 250. Page 250. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the Psikta Zutarte. As you can read, it's a midrashic work by Rabbi Tuvia ben Eliezer HaGadol. And perhaps I'll take an aside here, that when we call this a midrashic work, we have to be careful about that word midrash. Because the word midrash, which we're familiar with, can be used in a number of different senses. Midrash is a method of understanding the verses. It's a method in which you ask a question, you bring a verse, you ask a question, and you offer an answer. And very often when we're talking about midrash agadah, that answer is in the form of a story, of an embellishment upon the verses. So midrash is a method of interpretation, and that method could have been used 3,000 years ago and 2,000 years ago and 1,000 years ago and today. But on the other hand, we also use the word midrash in another sense. We refer to midrash in the sense of a use of this method at a certain time in Jewish history. Right? The classical midrashim, we're talking about the period of, let's say, from 200 years before the Common Era until 500 years after the Common Era. That's the period of the Mishnah and the period of the Talmud. When we talk about a midrash, a classic midrash, whether it's Midrash Rabbah, whether it's the Sifrei, the Mechilta, we're talking not just about a method, we're talking about a certain historical period. Again, it's the period of the Mishnah and the Talmud. After the year 200, after the year 500 of the Common Era, it's no longer the period of the classic Midrashim. And therefore, when we call Psikta Zutarte Midrash, I want to be careful, because it's a midrashic form, but it's written long after the time of the Talmud. It's written during the time of what we call the Rishonim, the medieval authorities, like Rashi and the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra and the Rambam, Maimonides, Nachmanides. So it's a midrashic work, but we wouldn't call it a midrash, right? Because again, we want to leave that term for the classic period of the Mishnah and the Talmud.
So they just call it a mishraki.
Midrashic work.
Right. Something like a Mishra.
Yeah.
Midrash.
But it's certainly of the works that we called Midrashic, it's the absolute latest in history. The absolute latest in history.
There's nothing later than 1108?
As far as Midrashic writings.
Oh.
After that, you find just you find exegesis. You find explanations of verses, but it's not in the same form of midrash, in which you take a verse and ask a question and then offer a story as an answer.
Okay.
Right? Usually, again, it's usually Rashi is not about, or the Ramban is not about, or the Rambam is not about creating legends to answer questions.
Hmm.
they're more about talking about ideas and concepts, but not just creating stories. Usually. So anyway, in the Psikta Zutarte, on our verses in the book of Exodus, it says, what caused Amalek to come and engage Israel in battle? Why did they do it? What was their motivation? What was bothering them? Because it doesn't look like they're looking to conquer land. It doesn't look like they're attacking those who've attacked their land. Mm-hmm. What do they want? Doesn't say. He was avenging his grandfather Esav. Because remember, we learned that Amalek is the grandson of Esav. As it says, Esav hated Yaakov. And that's when Esav found out that Yaakov stole his blessing by impersonating him in front of his father. Mm-hmm. Eliphaz was Esav's firstborn. Remember, Eliphaz was the father of Amalek through a concubine. And he was ordered to provoke Yaakov's progeny. In other words, Esav, on his deathbed, in his last will and testament, said, get Yaakov and his descendants. But being that he was raised in the company of Job and his friends, did not fight with them. So for some reason, Eliphaz didn't fulfill the evil decree of his father Esav, but passed it on to his son. Mm-hmm. And his son did what his father was supposed to do, that Esav commanded them to do. So now you're probably wondering, what does this have to do with Job? Well, Eov is Job.
Yeah, well, I know, I mean, we've studied Job, so I know that, I know Eliphaz from Job.
Ah,
the book of Job.
So you remember.
Yeah.
Right, so who is Eliphaz in the book of Job?
He's a friend.
He's a friend of Job. Right, so we can just open up quickly to the book of Job. The book of Job is near the end, and we're looking at page 1341 in the English only. 1341. The top of the page, verse 11. When Job's three friends heard about all these calamities that had befallen him, each came from his home, Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamite. So you see, Eliphaz. Now, it doesn't exactly work out because it's not clear that Eliphaz, our Eliphaz in the book of Genesis, was a Temanite. It rather says there that he has a brother who's called Teman. Let's just look that up a second, okay? That if we hold our fingers here in Job and go to the book of Genesis, something we saw an hour ago, so I'm going to Genesis 36. Oh, no, not a brother, a son. So I'm back in Genesis 36, verse 10. These are the names of Esav's sons. Eliphaz, the son of Esav's wife, Adah. Reuel, the son of Esav's wife, Bosmat. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman. Okay, so now you can say it fits. Eliphaz had a son called Teman. So perhaps Eliphaz went to live with his son in his old age, and the son had a clan that was called the clan of Teman. So in that sense, Eliphaz becomes a Temani. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have here in the book of Job, that Eliphaz the Temanite. So through connecting the book of Job with the book of Genesis, we come to the conclusion that Eliphaz was a good friend of Job. Now Job is a righteous guy. Now, if Job is a righteous guy, he certainly prevailed upon Eliphaz not to do evil things as his father Esav had commanded him to do. So now we understand why Eliphaz didn't fulfill his father's last will and testament, assuming there was such a thing, to get Jacob and his sons. But the son of Eliphaz, of course, the son we're talking about, Amalek, he came from a concubine. So he's already, he didn't go to school, right? He didn't get educated in the ways of Eliphaz and Job. So he went back and reverted to his grandfather's evil ways, Esav. So that, according to the Midrash, I shouldn't call it a Midrash, right? The Psikta, the very, very late medieval Midrash, we can call it. That's its explanation of why the clan and the tribe of Amalek went and attacked the Israelites because they were simply fulfilling an ancient grudge. It was a blood feud. So now what we have to do is we have to access a tradition that they didn't bring us here in the workbook. And that's a tradition that claims that since the birth of Jacob and Esav, they represent two clashing ideologies. Right? That Jacob, why did Jacob steal the birthright, the blessing, I'm sorry, from his brother? Because Jacob knew, and his mother, Rivka knew, that Esav is just not fitting to lead the Jewish people. He inherently doesn't have it in him. He's an evil character. Again, I'm not saying that this is true. I'm saying this is one midrashic trend of thought. That Jacob is born to be the leader of the Jewish people, and Esav is not. And therefore there's eternal enmity between them. It's something metaphysical that just has to be, because Esav represents evil and Yaakov represents good. And according to that way of reading it, when Amalek attacks the Israelites, all they're doing is they're continuing in the way of their forefather. They're giving expression to that inborn essence of evil.
Of course, I understand that that's one way to look at it, but I mean, even with this idea that they're just, you know, avenging the theft of the blessing. I mean, it didn't bear out when Jacob came back and met Esau, and they were, you know, they
good
appeared
point.
To be friendly.
And, good point. Very good. Very good. Right.
So this, it seems this as though it ended there. No reason to maintain mm-hmm. that.
But you're right.
He would have on his deathbed said, you know, avenge my...
You're right. What I can say is that this particular strand of thought claims that that reconciliation was only skin deep. The Midrash, a Midrash there says that when Esav and Jacob kissed and hugged and made up, Esav, when he fell on his brother's neck, it says, and kissed him, Esav was, oh, yeah, look at that, you know. It says he really meant to bite him and kill him, but he was prevented from doing so by the Holy Spirit. But it was all skin deep. And really, there is an eternal enmity that's based in values, in a clash of civilizations. So again, I'm not saying that that's the truth. There's lots of different ways of looking at it. And Caroline is right. That really goes against the grain of the explicit verses that says they made up. But here you can see how everything comes together. Because we see Amalek attacking the Jewish people for no reason. And because Amalek is a descendant of Esav. And because Esav had said, I hate Jacob. So there's good reason now to ignore the verses that talk about the reconciliation or to reinterpret them and to see here an internal enmity that's really what today is called the clash of civilizations. And there's absolutely no doubt that in the modern world, in the year 2012, when scholars, I think Bernard Lewis is one of the most famous ones, who talk about this clash of civilizations between Islam as embodying terrorism and the Western world represented by Israel and the US, there's no doubt that a lot of religious thinkers see that in light of what we're learning right now. Absolutely. And not all religious thinkers, perhaps not most, but many, many. There's even a midrashic statement that says halachahi Esav sone et Yaakov. It's a halakha that Esav hates Yaakov. And here, halakha obviously doesn't mean a commandment. It means something in the kishkes. It's something in the DNA that Esav will always hate Yaakov. And although it's expressed here through Amalek, Esav becomes Amalek. In the modern world, there are those who say Islamic terrorism is an expression of that. It's another Gilgul. It's another reincarnation of that same eternal hate that can never be quenched, can never be dealt with. Again, I'm not saying this is true, and I'm not saying it's the right thing. But I think that this Midrash is giving expression to that. This Midrash in the Psikta. I can, you know, if I'm just going on a rant here, I can I can say that there are many thinkers that say that it's this very way of thinking that is liable to cause future killing and hate and wars. In other words, when you demonize one side and say they always will hate us no matter what we do, you're basically dooming yourself to repeat history again and again and again. And in a certain sense, you can say this is a conflict between liberals and conservatives. You can say, you know, I'm not being 100% accurate here, but more or less, conservative point of view, with a small c, I mean, of course, would say that's the fact. You have to recognize that they hate us, and you have to hunker down and accept it. They hate us. We have to always fight them. Whereas a liberal point of view, it says, wait a second, nothing is ever engraved in stone. You have to try and change that. You have to try and deal with it and, I wouldn't say appease, but educate, be involved in dialogue, and do something about that hate and to dissipate it.
It certainly does seem to be the situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that they, there seems like, that, well, of course, they've been taught to hate, Palestinians have been taught to hate the Jews, but so that has a lot to do with it. But even so, I mean, it's like they can't forget anything. I mean, they just go back for thousands of years, and they're still, you know, just feel like there's...
Yeah, and
they
that's...
They have to hate the Jews.
And there are those who would say that's part of the DNA, and it's part of the very structure of the universe, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that, again, is one way of interpreting our verses about Amalek. I think it's the way that this psikta is going to interpret it. It goes back to the dawn of time. And therefore, you have to fight against it and try and blot out its memory for all generations. Okay. Heavy stuff here. Now we're going to look at commentary 3. We'll skip 2. And we'll go to 3. Okay, so 3 and 4 we'll do together. They're very short. One is the Yalkut Shimoni.
That just blows my mind. All these different collections of, in this case, a collection of Midrashim, but so many, all the different texts that we have that are just new to me, you know, that I've never heard of before. It's just so amazing that I could live this long and not have heard of these.
Yeah, there is a lot. There's a lot.
Good.
And just let me say that it's so disappointing to me. You know, I teach a class, Nancy, in the Beit Midrash of Sherith Israel. And there's basically no books in the Beit Midrash. It just drives me crazy.
There are books there. They're just not as...
There's almost nothing. It drives me crazy because, from my point of view, even if no one would ever open books, but they just be there to show us that is our tradition, that's our past. And what we've been doing is writing books and reading books and developing the tradition for so many thousands of years. And if you're not aware of that tradition, it's just going to disappear.
Well, I'd like to correct that. Maybe someday you'll make me a list of things that should be there, you think were important to
maybe
be there.
Are they in the rabbi? Maybe they're in the rabbi.
Oh, the rabbi's got a huge, a whole right. wall
he's
of books.
Anything that would be in the Beit Midrash.
Well, yeah. He's got a whole taken. Wall of books with all this stuff, I'm sure. But what would be, maybe you make me a list. You know, I'm sure Rabbi Gershon could do that too. Yeah. But
what are you going to donate $100,000?
Well, some amount, maybe.
Okay, yeah. I'd be happy to sit down with you.
Yeah.
But I know, getting off topic, I'll just say for one more minute. But then someone could say, they could say, what are you doing it for? No one's going to open them up. There's no point in it.
Well, somebody will if they're there. I mean, I'm sure that there would be some people, if they were there, would perhaps look at it. Or they could, you know, in the bulletins and all, they could say, you know, we've got these new books.
Yeah, they could lend them out if people wanted to.
That's the other thing. They might just take them from the Beit Midrash.
And never return them.
And never return them. But, I mean, but still, like you say, maybe they'd never even be used.
But the idea of a Beit Midrash is not a lending library, but to have them there so people could come and be involved in study.
To use them there and to study.
So do you bring your own books with you when you teach there?
To a large degree, I prepare at home from books I have at home, and then I come and teach. I think that there's only I don't know how many.
We have two sets of Talmud there.
Yeah. Okay.
I have the Zohar.
Yeah. Okay, so if you remind me, if you're serious, I'd be happy to.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to. So anyway, the Yalkut Shimoni, very interesting, is a collection of Midrashim. In other words, it's not original. It's not that someone in the 15th century wrote Midrash. It's that, rather, in the 15th century, someone took Midrashim from many different collections and put them together in one convenient encyclopedic work. Mm. And what happened is that some of the sources of the Yalkut Shimoni have, since the 15th century, been lost. So there are some Midrashim that we know only from Yalkut Shimoni, although we know that in the 15th century they were just copied from someplace else, but we've lost that original source. So the Yalkut Shimoni therefore has become very, very important, although it's only an anthology, not original work. So, says the Yalkut Shimoni, do the hands of Moshe strengthen Yisrael or break Amalek? Right? From the story, it says Moses put his hands up, they were victorious, put them down, they failed. How could that be? What's the connection between the strengthening of Yisrael and the breaking of Amalek on the one hand, and the hands of Moshe on the other hand? There's no connection. How could it be? What's going on? Rather, as long as Moshe was raising his hands towards the heavens, and of course those words are added towards the heavens, giving a religious connotation to it, the Israelites would look at him and have faith in the one that ordered Moshe to do this, and God in turn would perform for them miracles and mighty acts. So, according to the pshat of the text, there's no connection, no logical connection between the hands going up and down and the battle going good or bad. That's just what happens. And I would say, according to the pshat of the text, it's just to show us that God's in charge. Because the staff of Moses is in his hand, and the staff reminds us of God's miracles, just to show us that the whole battle is miraculous. But Yalkut Shimoni wants to understand it more logically. How does the miracle work? It's a miracle, but how does the miracle work? So the way it works is that the hands are an object of sight. And the Israelites look at his hands. The verse didn't say that. Didn't say no one's looking at his hands. But the Midrash says the Israelites are looking at his hands. And when they looked at his hands and looked at the staff in his hands, they remembered God. And when they remembered God and they had faith in him, that's when God did miracles for them. So the implication is that yes, God's in charge and God does miracles, but God does miracles only for those who deserve it. How do you deserve it? By having faith. When did they have faith? When they looked at the staff and remembered God. When the staff was put down, they forgot God. So the Yalkut Shimoni indeed emphasizes the miraculous, but it adds the miraculous, the element of the Israelites in being worthy of the miraculous. They're only worthy of it when they have faith. By the way, remember there was nothing of this sort in all the plagues. The plagues, it never said they had to be worthy to have the plagues done for them. They were just done because God wanted to save them. Whereas here, the Yalkut Shimoni is adding a degree of human responsibility. Only when the human beings have faith, then does God save them.
Well, they've gotten, at this point, they've been to Sinai, right?
No.
Well, they're still not there.
Remember, we said that chapters 12 and 13, they leave.
Right.
14 and 15 is the splitting of the sea. 16 is the manna, and 17 is where we are right now. They don't come to Sinai until 19 and 20, verses 19 and 20, okay. Chapters 19 and 20.
Okay.
And remember also that the manna was about teaching the Israelites that there's nothing they can do to improve their fate. It's all from God.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they make the effort to collect manna, they won't get more than they need for that day. So it's not about human responsibility at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're still in the where they just have to depend on God, and they need to have that faith renewed by having his hands up.
Mm-hmm. So now let's see the Tanhuma. Midrash Tanhuma, which is an original Midrash. In other words, it's not a collection anthology. It is an original source. Do Moses' hands make or break a war? Of course not. Rather, as long as the Israelites would look up to the heavens and would submit themselves to their Father in heaven, they would gain superiority. But if they would not, they would fall. So my question is, what is the essential difference between the approach of the Tanhuma and the approach of the Yalkut Shimoni?
The only difference I can see is that they had faith that one that ordered Moses to do it is sort of like there's one's going through Moses.
I think there's something
else.
Something else.
Okay, the sure it just says they would look up to the heavens.
Right.
They bypassed Moses.
Mm-hmm. And clearly, according to the Tanhuma, they look up to heaven because they see Moses' hand. Right? The question was, do Moses' hands make or break a war? No. Right? As long as the Israelites would look to heaven, in other words, they looked to heaven when they saw Moses' hand. So Moses' hands with the staff remind them of heaven.
Okay.
Remind them of heaven. And then they submit themselves to the Father in heaven, which is just like it says in the first Midrash, the Yalkut, that they would look at him and have faith in the one mm-hmm. in God. So I'm claiming, oh, that's the same.
It sounds.
What's the difference? What is found in the first Midrash that's not found in the second?
That Moses had to keep his hands up to keep them looking up.
No, but that's in the text of the Torah, right? That when he put his hands down, the battle went bad.
Okay.
But what's missing from the second that's not in the first? I'm sorry, missing from the second that's not in the second, that's in the first.
One they're looking at Moses and one they're looking at the heavens, but you say that's sort of the same.
I think it's the same.
Okay. Have faith in God, the other says submit themselves.
Well, that's pretty much the same.
That sounds the same. And if they do that, that they're going to gain superiority and that God will, and the other one says, will perform miracles and mighty acts. That sounds the same to me.
Perhaps not.
Okay.
Perhaps that's different.
Perform the miracles, gain superiority. But one's God's going to perform the miracles, and this one, that when you say gain superiority, like that maybe from their own strength, they would gain superiority with his help.
Even without his help. In other words, perhaps in the Tanhuma, we're being told that faith in and of itself, in a very, very naturalistic fashion, faith engenders self-confidence and the ability to prevail. I'll read it again. The Tanhuma. Do Moses' hands make or break a war? Rather, as long as the Israelites would look up to the heavens, would submit themselves to the Father in heaven, they would gain superiority, but if not, they would fail, and there's no mention there of a miracle.
Right.
In other words, Moses was standing there, and he was goading them on to faith in God by showing them the staff. When they remembered God, they had confidence in what they were doing, because they believed that God was with them. But that doesn't mean that God did a miracle. It means the very faith in God in and of itself is powerful enough in a psychological sense to empower them and embolden them to fight better, to fight harder, to fight with more courage and resolve. Whereas in the Yalkut, there it's about divine intervention. There, because they had faith, therefore God helped them. But that step of God helping them perhaps is missing from the Midrash Tanhuma. So you could say that they're both about the staff of Moshe and the hands of Moshe engendering faith. But the difference is, what is the value of faith? How does faith work? The second source from the Tanhuma says faith is an independent factor in human psychology that makes you function with greater confidence and with greater resolve and therefore with greater success. Whereas Yalkut says that that faith is a merit that brings God to intervene. That's pretty big difference, yeah, and it's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. To talk in terms of Thursday mornings, Stephanie would like the Midrash Tanhuma.
Yeah.
Because it leaves God out of it.
Right.
In a certain sense. It's a naturalistic approach, whereas the Yalkut is perhaps a supernatural approach.
Yeah.
But the truth is that neither of those approaches is in line with what we've seen until now in the book of Exodus. Right? Both of these approaches say it begins with man. Then Tanhuma says man has to have faith and that propels him forward. The Yalkut says man has faith and that causes God to act on his behalf. But both of those approaches have man at the foundation. It depends on him. Whereas the truth is, in the rest of the book of Exodus, we've seen until now, man didn't play a role at all. It was all about God. Mm-hmm. Which brings us back to what I had said an hour ago, that perhaps the simple meaning of it is not about man at all. It's just about showing us that God is doing everything. The hand up there just shows us that God's in charge. It's not about the soldiers looking at the hand. It's not about faith. It's not about merit. It's not about confidence. It's not about any of that. Perhaps it's just about the fact that here's the staff to remind us that the staff is doing everything. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it was in the plagues. Okay. So now we have time for one more commentary. So if it turns out we have a class next week, there's enough commentaries left here. Some very, very exciting and interesting and relevant things to see. Okay. And if we don't have a class, then you can just look on your own. Sure. So the fifth commentary is Don Yitzhak Abarbanel. And he was a medieval author, philosopher. He was also the member of the court of Ferdinand Isabel when the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, and he was expelled together with the rest of the Jews. So, and he recorded four despicable things which Amalek did. I don't know if the Abarbanel is quoting some other author, some other he. I don't know about that. First, they battled with the Israelites for no reason. Some soldiers will go to war against enemies that are coming to try to take and conquer their land. So they will go out to do battle and neutralize the threat. Others will go to conquer the lands of others, leading to battle. But Amalek did not have these reasons for going to war. For the Israelites were not passing through his land, threatening war when he went out to them. Nor did they have any land that Amalek should desire to conquer, leading to battle. The only reason for this war was that they were going out of Egypt. He wanted to hinder them on the way, thus getting himself involved in a battle not his own. So it just says they did it for no reason. Mm-hmm. So, and why did they do it? Doesn't say. Why? Not clear. Yeah. But there seems to be no logical reason. No justifiable reason. Second, it is the custom of kings that prior to engaging a nation in battle, they inform their enemies that they are coming, saying to them, prepare your weapons, for I am coming to do battle against you. As it says in Jeremiah, take your positions and be ready, so that they should not come as robbers in the night. Amalek did not do so. They orchestrated a surprise attack. Right? They didn't declare war.
That's interesting. That was a custom of kings to actually tell a nation they were coming to
declare war.
Uh-huh.
Because in many cases, the nation coming to make war, they'd prefer to have the nation in front of them just capitulate, surrender, and pay tribute.
Yeah.
Right. So you want to declare war, say, I want to conquer you. If you prefer to avoid battle, you know, give me all your males and I'll enslave them, or give me all your females and I'll rape them, or give me all your money.
Yeah.
Right. I see. But Amalek didn't declare war. They were terrorists, to use modern terms. Third, part of the inferiority and fear of the Amalekites was that they would not be able to summon the strength to battle with Yisrael head on. Right? They were small force, perhaps, just marauders. Instead, they fought with the weak ones who were pulling up the rear of the camp, afraid to strike the people from the front. And this is even with Yisrael being tired and worn out. So again, they were terrorists. They weren't coming head on to do battle, taking the easy way out, trying to inflict damage. Fourth, what is said, he did not fear God, and we talked about that phrase earlier. This scoundrel issued orders out of his concern and fear of the people who were tired and worn out, but he did not fear God who deposes kings. In this way, Moses indicated that Amalek sinned against both God and Yisrael, and for this reason, vengeance was coming both from God's side, as indicated in Bishalach, that's in Exodus, and from Yisrael's side, as indicated here. Deuteronomy says, we do war against them to blot out their name, and Exodus says that God will do the same. So the point seems to be, going back to what we talked about, at the end of Shirat Hayam, at the end of the song at the sea, that the nation saw what God did in Mitzrayim and were quaking at this great power, whereas the Amalekites, they didn't fear God. They had perhaps, say, a reason of some sort to battle against God. So that's the approach of the Abarbanel, which we can call, compared to other things we'll see next week if we do, a realistic approach. Try and understand the things on the level, not of metaphysics, not of vast ideas and concepts, but simply, they did these terrible things. They were terrorists. They attacked from the rear. They didn't follow the Geneva Convention. They didn't declare war. And they didn't have any respect for the great God who took the Israelites out of Egypt. And that's why, for all generations, we are to do battle against them. And then we'll see, if we see next time, the approaches that take this metaphysically and conceptually and philosophically and morally, whole story.
I still don't understand how we can blot out his name and then but be at war with him for all
right.
time.
Right, we have to get to that, if we get to it. There are certainly commentaries that talk about that. And just to whet your appetite, there's a very, very powerful commentary here written during the Holocaust that directly connects this to the experiences in the Warsaw Ghetto, which is really, really powerful.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah, very nice for you to do this class for the two of us.
Rabbi Kalash Shapiro, is that
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Eish Kodesh. His sermons that he spoke during the Warsaw Ghetto uprising.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm surprised if you know what to do.
It's hard because it's coming up a holiday weekend.
Well, and it's there's a lot of graduations. People, a lot of people I know have left town to go